This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on the show, we will visit with Tim Young. He is the executive director of the HIV Alliance in Baton Rouge, and he is a busy man. Baton Rouge has the highest AIDS rate in America. In the last few years, approximately 30 people have been diagnosed for every 100,000 residents in this city. In both 2010 and 2011 reporting years, been diagnosed with the HIV virus. We'll talk with Tim Young about the epidemic in our community. Also on the show, Dr. Michael Desmond, well-known architect nationally, and he is, of course, a professor at Louisiana State University, and his book is The Architecture of LSU, about one of the most splendid settings in America. We'll talk about it with Michael Desmond. Now the news. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Good morning, and hope you had a good weekend, and happy Mother's Day again to those who it applies. And we start our week with Tim Young. He is executive director of the HIV Alliance in Baton Rouge. He started this organization as its lone employee in 1996. The group now has 50 employees with a $10 million annual budget, and Baton Rouge, unfortunately, has the highest AIDS rate in the United States. 297-5633 if you'd like to join our discussion with Tim, and if you would prefer to join us online, inkstershow@wrkf.org. Well, first of all, when we say Baton Rouge has the highest AIDS rate in America, Tim, how are those figures, how are they defined? How does the CDC come up with the rankings it has?
All states, in particular Louisiana, has a very robust epidemiological surveillance system. And so they get a lot of information from doctor's offices, hospitals, laboratories, and they accumulate that information and they record it, they report it to the CDC. And so then those cases are translated into a rate per 100,000 people.
And our rate for 2011, which is the latest reporting year, is right at 30 per 100,000. Year before that, it was 34 per 100,000. We were number one both in 2010 and 2011. Why does Baton Rouge have a higher rate than, say, New Orleans, which also is extremely high, but let's say Jackson, Mississippi, or Austin, Texas? Why are we ahead of them?
Well, particularly Jackson, Mississippi is also in the top 10 of cities. In fact, if we look at the 20 highest cities in the country for HIV AIDS rates, 17 of them are in the South. So it's an epidemic that is affecting minority populations, particularly in the South, the Northeast, and the West. And it's affecting a low-income population that has limited access to health care. And we also have the highest HIV STD rates in general in Louisiana. We're number one for primary and secondary syphilis, number one in the country for chlamydia, number three for gonorrhea, number three for congenital syphilis.
All right, hold that thought. That's Baton Rouge?
That's Louisiana.
Louisiana. Number one in syphilis, number one in gonorrhea, number one in homicides. Are we number one in anything that's good?
I'm sure that we are, LSU football.
Yeah, well, it's in 2007, but that's been 6 years.
Yes, well, HIV is certainly a problem, and we know that if HIV has a sort of a mixed situation here, untreated, it's still a deadly disease, mm-hmm. and we're still losing people from it. Treatment can be very effective, but you have to be tested, you have to know that you have HIV, and you have to seek treatment.
It's estimated, what, that 20% of those who have it don't know it.
Right. And you're going to be hearing more about that in the days ahead, about the treatment cascade. So about 80% of those who are infected know that they have mm-hmm. HIV. About 60% of those are linked to care. About 40% are in care and on antiretroviral treatment, and only about a third are virally suppressed.
So I mentioned that you started your organization, the HIV Alliance in 1996, 17 years ago, and you had one employee. You now have 50 and a $10 million annual budget. Where does your funding come from?
It's all federal funding, primarily from the Ryan White Care Act, federal funds that go for primary care and medications, medical transportation mm-hmm. to doctor's appointments, antiretroviral medications, and housing primarily.
You do testing?
We do testing. We have the only CDC-funded HIV prevention funding in the city of Baton Rouge. We do testing. We do risk reduction counseling with people who are at high risk for HIV. And we do a evidence-based intervention with African-American women to help them reduce their risk.
You say it affects the minority community more so than others. Why?
I think they have a limited access to health care traditionally, historically. And it does affect the African-American population here in a disproportionate amount. Blacks in Baton Rouge are seven times, in Louisiana, are seven times more likely to be infected than whites.
But the most likely way to get infected, and there are various ways, obviously, blood transfusions, IV drug use, but is unprotected sexual activity, right?
That's right. Unprotected sex, and more than half of the new diagnoses are among gay, bisexual, and other men who have sex with men.
And one of the highest rates as far as increase are females, right?
Baton Rouge has the highest percentage of HIV-positive women among all the regions of the state. But statewide, the rates for women are relatively stable. The fastest-growing group is probably young people aged 13 to 24.
Mm-hmm. But women are getting it primarily from men through sexual activity.
That's right.
And the men may or may not be straight, gay, bisexual. This is something that affects all sectors of society now, doesn't it?
It does. And if we look at where the rates are the highest in Louisiana, there is some correlation between high rates and the number of correctional facilities in that area. So we don't know that there's necessarily any causation, but there is a correlation there.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
297-5633, a difficult subject, and one that, as I've noted, most politicians shy away from discussing. They'll talk about the budget. They may talk about social issues of all kinds. But when it comes to AIDS, when's the last time you had a press conference with a governor or a state lawmaker or a congressman? It just doesn't happen. Why do we not want to talk about this, Tim Young?
That's a really good question. You know, if you ask someone, have you had an HIV test, then for a lot of people, there's automatically a stigma. Why are you asking me? Why do you think I need one? What do you think that I've done to need an HIV test? And I think that's a bad attitude that affects us in our community that avoids the conversation. We really need for everyone to know their status. There was a study that came out a few years ago, the HIV Prevention Trials Network, study number 052. You can search for it, HPT and 052, that said that for people who were in serodiscordant couples, where one person was infected and their partner was not, if the infected partner was on treatment, then they were 96% less likely to transmit the infection on to their uninfected partner. So we know that if we can get people tested and get them on treatment, then they're less likely to pass the virus on to someone else, and that will help us lower our rates.
Okay, 297-5633. Laurie in Kenilworth asked the distinction between HIV and AIDS. What is the distinction?
HIV is a virus, sort of like a cold or the flu. Although it's not contagious, it's sexually transmitted primarily. AIDS is a progression of HIV infection that weakens the immune system and leads to the presence of opportunistic infections.
Well, when Magic Johnson announced in 1991 that he was HIV positive, many, including myself, I might add, thought he would certainly be dead within a decade. Here we are, what, 22 years later? He looks like the picture of health. How does he do it?
Effective medication. And that's the real story about HIV. It's a highly treatable disease. The medications are highly effective. Someone diagnosed with HIV today can have a normal life expectancy if they're tested early and they get treated. Unfortunately, in Baton Rouge, we have a situation where a lot of people test late.
Mm-hmm. But if somebody has the HIV virus, as Magic Johnson has for 22 years, and they engage in unprotected sexual activity, then there's a prospect that they're going to infect other people.
There is that chance, although the medications are so highly effective at reducing the viral load in the bloodstream that that's what the study pointed to, that there is a significant reduction of the chance that they're going to infect someone else if they're on effective treatment.
All right. 877-217-5757, wherever you are. Inkster Show at WRKF.org if you would like to engage Tim Young through the internet. Allison wants to know if these figures that I cited are yearly figures or total figures. They're yearly figures, right? The 30 per 100,000, that's a yearly figure for people contracting AIDS.
Right. That's the rate for the number of people diagnosed with AIDS in that particular year per 100,000 people.
And to put it in perspective, on a Saturday night at Tiger Stadium, when there are close to 100,000 people there, when you count all the fans and the teams and the ushers and everybody in the stadium, the sports writers, sportscasters, that means about 30 on average in Baton Rouge would be diagnosed with AIDS in that year. Now, what is the total number for AIDS in Baton Rouge right now? Do we have a handle on that?
Statewide, there are about 19,000 people living with HIV/AIDS throughout the state. There have been about 35,000 cumulative ever since
19,000?
So 35,000 cumulative, 15,000 have died. There are about 19,000 in the state. There are 5,000 in the Baton Rouge area who are living with HIV and AIDS.
5,000.
Right.
297-5633, Ann in Lafayette. Ann, good morning. You're on the air with Tim Young, director of the HIV Alliance in Baton Rouge. Hi, Ann.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I'd like to know whether your guest would address the possibility of there being problems if the husband has the disease and his wife wants to get pregnant.
The husband has the disease and the wife wishes to get pregnant. What are the risks? Also, what are the risks, if any, in that case, of the child having it? Obviously, the risk is much higher if the mother has AIDS, but what about if the
That is entirely possible. If the, you know, the danger is that the husband could infect the wife with HIV, but I do believe that there. That is possible. They should consult their physician. For a mother who is HIV positive, there really is no reason today that they should pass that infection on to their child. The protocols for perinatal infection are very good, and that involves giving the mother AZT during pregnancy, infusion during delivery, and then AZT to the child for a period of time after birth. And some states, perinatal infection is so low that they've actually stopped surveillance. Now, in Louisiana, a couple of years ago, we had 8 perinatal infections in 1 year, primarily due to the lack of prenatal care. So our rates are still a little bit high for perinatal infection in Louisiana. But that is potentially possible. They should consult a physician.
And I guess another question that some are probably thinking is why in the world would somebody who has AIDS father a child with that condition?
For the same reason anyone else would, because someone today with HIV infection should be able to live long enough to see their children grow up and watch their grandchildren grow up.
297-5633. We'll be back with Tim Young, director of the HIV Alliance in Baton Rouge. Inkster Show at WRKF.org online. Back in 90 seconds. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Tim Young, director, executive director of the HIV Alliance in Baton Rouge. Hart is with us. He's held that position for 17 years. $10 million in annual funding from the federal government for this organization. And it started with one employee, Mr. Young, pride of Eunice, Louisiana. That's a town that's produced many fine journalists through the years, and Tim is a man who is quite eloquent in what he says. Why is there no state funding for your group?
You'd have to ask the legislature.
Have you tried? Have you tried?
I have not tried directly. Although state funding for HIV prevention has been reduced in the past period of time. And so there are currently no state funds mm-hmm. or city funds that I'm aware of that directly go to HIV prevention.
Now, I've chided lawmakers and the governor for not being more forthcoming about this scourge in our midst. What could he do that he's not doing, if anything?
That's a good question. I think that one thing that we could do would be Medicaid expansion, although I know that there are a lot of concerns about that. Medicaid expansion would certainly help individuals who are living with HIV in accessing their care, although I don't know what it would do to the state budget. I'm certainly not qualified to make that decision.
But is there a reluctance to discuss this because it's not good for business? Certainly doesn't put the best light on Louisiana or Baton Rouge. Now, the mayor has talked a bit about it, not a lot, but some. But at your events, for example, do state lawmakers come? Do they attend your events?
They do, and I have to commend Mayor Holden. He has done more than all other previous mayors combined toward raising awareness about HIV. And we have had a number of politicians, leaders, attend our events. We had Congressman Bill Cassidy a few years ago at an AIDS candlelight memorial, which we have coming up next Sunday, this coming Sunday, May 19th, will be the 30th International AIDS Candlelight Memorial downtown, and Mayor Holden will be welcoming the crowd.
Will Congressman Cassidy be there?
We didn't invite him this year. That's our fault.
Well, so there's still time. It's May 19th.
There is still time. Maybe we can get that out to him today. I'm sure he's not going to appreciate being asked at the last minute, but he has been there before, and he was a terrific speaker.
Al in Iberville Terrace. Hi, Al. You're on the air with Tim Young.
Good morning. I appreciate you taking my call. When AIDS first showed up in the late 1970s, it was primarily a disease of homosexuals, then drug addicts, and only lately, or at least more later, it showed up as a disease of heterosexuals. Could you tell us what the breakdown of homosexual AIDS, drug AIDS, and heterosexual AIDS is in Baton Rouge, Louisiana?
Do you know that, Tim?
About half, 50 to 60% is due to men who have sex with men. About 30% is due to high-risk heterosexual activity, and maybe about 10% or so is injection drug use.
Is there a problem, if you will, of men who have it and don't reveal it to their partners and transmit it to people who have no idea that their partner has AIDS?
It certainly seems that way. Half of all new infections in the Baton Rouge area are among gay, bisexual, and men who have sex with men, and they are transmitting it on to others. Every person should take responsibility for themselves, but there obviously is transmission going on among that community, and we certainly know that they have education to mm-hmm. help protect themselves from acquiring HIV infection. It just goes to show how difficult it is to change behavior.
Yeah. You remember the book And the Band Played On?
I do.
Randy Schultz?
Yes.
He noted in his book that in the early years of AIDS, there was one man in particular who spread it to a whole lot of people by himself, and that was one of the sparks for the disease spreading.
Exactly. And you know, with the whole social media thing going on, we see how information spreads, and sexual activity spreads in a very similar way. You know, this has been studied, and we know that there are core transmitters, those people who acquire STDs and transmit them to multiple people who then further spread them out into the community in smaller numbers.
We have a question from David who says, where and when can people be tested free of charge for AIDS?
They can be tested at our offices at 4550 North Boulevard near Baton Rouge Community College. Each day of the week, 8 to 5, no appointment is needed. You can make an appointment if you'd like one. If you're concerned about privacy, you can call us at 927-1269. We'll make an appointment for you. But you can walk in. You don't need an appointment. We test all day long. And it takes about 20 minutes to get your results. So in the time that we've been talking today, someone could have had an HIV test and gotten their results.
So it's a blood test, right?
No, it's a oral swab. It's a little plastic thing with a receptor on the end. You put it into your mouth, rub it along the inside of your gum a couple of times, put it in a solution, and then it gives you a marker, sort of like a pregnancy test.
Jamie asks a question online. What about donating blood? Is there a risk in doing this? Obviously, if you're infected, there's a big risk. You shouldn't do it. But what about people who are engaging in some of these practices like unsafe sex, IV drug use? They probably shouldn't be donating blood, should they?
They shouldn't be, although the blood supply is thoroughly tested, and we believe it to be safe, perfectly safe.
And I was just looking at a story on AIDS and the rate of transmission for somebody who has a blood transfusion, a bad one, it's like 90%. You can have unprotected sex and you might get lucky many times, but if you have a blood transfusion that's tainted, you're in trouble usually.
That's right. Blood to blood transmission is very high. Sexual transmission is somewhat lower. Oral sex tends to be very low, so there's a degree of risk in various types of transmission.
When this was first on the horizon back in the early 80s, people were terrified of this disease. It hasn't gone away. Why has it been tamped down as far as the urgency in eradicating the world of AIDS?
I think there was so much fear because it stole people away from us in such a tragic way. They acquired lots of opportunistic infections. They wasted away to nothing, and there was nothing that could be done for them. So it was essentially a black plague. And I think that now that people have become more educated, medications have become more effective, people have a more realistic viewpoint of HIV as being a disease that is treatable.
Okay. Jennifer, following up on our discussion, and I said that, or I asked you if it was a blood test, asked if it can be tested through blood.
Oh, sure. Absolutely. Yeah. What we use is a rapid test that doesn't involve blood because that's what's easiest for most people. No needles, no blood. You can get your results in 20 minutes. The standard confirmatory test is a Western blot, which is a blood test.
What about those who don't engage in particularly high-risk behavior but still would like to know? Would you advise them to have a test, or is that really necessary?
CDC recently announced again that they recommend testing, universal testing, for everyone between 15 and 65 years of age. So You know, one of the things that we need to do is identify everyone who has HIV and get them on treatment to minimize the chance that they might pass that infection on to someone else. The only way that we're going to know is if we test everyone. So we recommend universal testing.
Well, the 2011 figures, that's the last reporting year that's available.
Yes.
Baton Rouge was number one. 29 out of every 100,000 in that year were diagnosed with AIDS. Miami was second, rate of 28 per 100,000. Atlanta third at 27. New Orleans fourth, rate of 25. And Baltimore was ranked fifth, rate of 24. As you note, these are southern cities, cities with high crime levels, high poverty levels, and in some cases, poor educational measurements. Does all that kind of blend together?
It does. And I know that not everybody considers Baltimore a southern city, but
it is.
It is. And if we and the other southern cities are Memphis and Jackson, Mississippi, and Columbia, South Carolina, and Jacksonville, it's where the affected population is low-income minorities with limited access to health care, existing in an environment of high STD rates in general.
Well, with Louisiana having the number one city and the number five city, we're probably number one as a state in the United
We're actually
States.
Number four for HIV and three for AIDS. I might have those backwards, but among states, we're three and four for
HIV. Who's ahead of Louisiana?
I believe that South Carolina is ahead of us and Georgia.
This is on a percentage basis,
yes.
not on a total number case, but on a percentage basis. And you also noted that Louisiana is unfortunately number one in several other sexually transmitted diseases. How often, and this is a good question from Polly, how often does HIV diagnosis come after somebody's been diagnosed with another sexually transmitted disease?
Well, the presence of another sexually transmitted disease does make HIV infection easier to acquire, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to come together. So I'm not quite sure I understand the question.
Well, is it more likely that somebody with a sexually transmitted disease like syphilis, you said we're number one in the nation in syphilis, or gonorrhea, in Louisiana number one in gonorrhea, is it more likely that somebody with those kinds of STDs would be an AIDS victim?
Not necessarily, although, yes, that the presence of another sexually transmitted disease does make it easier for HIV to transmit.
297-5633, Michael Desmond, the remarkable architect and professor at LSU, is on deck with his book, The Architecture of LSU, but we have a few more minutes with Mr. Tim Young, who's head of the HIV Alliance in Baton Rouge, if you'd like to join the conversation with Tim Young. 877-217-5757, inkstershow@wrkf.org. And Kevin, you're going to have to point me to the next caller. It is Chris on I-10. Chris, good morning. You're on with Tim. Hi, Chris.
Good morning, gentlemen. How are y'all doing?
Fine.
Good.
I was calling regarding the AIDS thing, obviously, but the behavioral aspects of it, being that it is primarily a behavioral transmitted disease, what are educational focuses on this? It seems like if people can be educated and educated in proper, I guess you'd say, populations, that could be more effective.
We do provide educational outreach. We go out to places where men who have sex with men frequent, and we set up a booth and provide educational information, distribute condoms, talk with them, encourage them to reduce their high-risk behavior. We also have a CDC-funded program that as people come to us for HIV testing, we assess them for their risk factors, and if they're at high risk, then we can provide one-on-one counseling with them to help change their behaviors over time.
All right, and there's a question from Annie, kind of a follow-up to Chris, saying should Governor Jindal and Congressman Cassidy and Senator Clater and Representative Carter be calling for distribution of condoms? Is that a good thing?
The CDC says that condoms do lower the infection rates for sexually transmitted diseases, including HIV. Condoms are effective in reducing those transmission rates in areas of high incidence.
It's interesting that many lawmakers, public officials, they like the idea of we as a people having as many guns as possible, but they don't want us to have access to condoms. Do you see a disconnect there at all?
I think that we could benefit from a broad range of sexual education in our state to include abstinence, but also a more comprehensive curriculum.
Well, this is an issue that it should be relevant in any race. For example, next year when Congressman Cassidy runs against Senator Landrieu, I would hope that there might be a debate dedicated solely to this issue. Do you see that as a prospect or a positive thing that could happen?
I can certainly see this being a question in that debate. It was a question in the mayoral debate here recently. This is a major issue affecting Louisiana. You know, a lot of these people who are acquiring HIV infection are uninsured. And so we're paying for their care with our tax dollars. And so we can save money by lowering infection rates. So we could any money put into prevention will be saved in the long run.
All right. Well, tell us about your event on the 19th once again.
Okay. On the 19th, Sunday at 6 p.m., this coming Sunday, May 19th, at the North Boulevard Town Square, we're going to be having the International AIDS Candlelight Memorial Service. It's the 30th International AIDS Candlelight Memorial. We've been doing this for a long time in Baton Rouge. I don't know that we've been doing it 30 years, but I know that we've been doing it for 20 or more years. Sunana Chen, who is the Community Outreach Coordinator for the Mayor's Healthy City Initiative, is going to be our MC. We're going to have an opening prayer by Reverend Betty Claiborne. And we're going to have a welcome by Mayor Kip Holden. We're going to have music by the New Orleans Gay Men's Chorus. We'll have an update on statistics from Mr. Eugene Collins, who's the Regional Coordinator for the STD HIV Program. STD statistics are going to be flashed on the big screen down there. Councilman Donna Collins Lewis is going to join us. Our sponsor is Avita Drugs Pharmacy. There's going to be a 12-block memorial walk. We're going to leave a wreath, a remembrance wreath, right, at the door of City Hall.
Okay,
and
that's
then we'll
this Sunday. I want to get to a few other comments here. One from Aaron Lawler, who says there is access to condoms for all. You just want my taxes to pay for it, writes Aaron. What about the prevention of AIDS through condom use? It would seem that that might ultimately be something that would be beneficial as far as the tax burden, because people who have AIDS quite often end up having to have the taxpayers help foot the bill for their treatment.
It does sound like it might be cost effective. And then using condoms is not necessarily something that everybody thinks of. That it's a behavior that needs to be taught, and people need to be educated about it to help protect themselves from acquiring sexually transmitted diseases.
What about condoms for young people? That's one that is a hot potato, providing condoms for people who are in schools, for example. Is that a good idea?
I don't believe that condoms are distributed in any of our schools.
But should they?
Should they be? I think that would be a choice for the parents of the children at each particular school.
Tim Young, thank you, sir. Look forward to a further discussion with you about this most provocative topic. And we'll return with Professor Michael Desmond after this 90-second pause on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. We're visiting with Professor Michael Desmond. He's an architecture professor at LSU, a graduate of the university, also a graduate of Harvard, where he received his master's degree, and a PhD from MIT. And he is a man who knows good architecture when he sees it, and he has a family connection to Louisiana State University as well. 22 years as a professor. The book is The Architecture of LSU, a fantastic read, and for anybody who is mesmerized by the majesty of the campus at Louisiana State University, this is a good book to look at. Let's start with a family connection. Your dad was quite profound in this area as well.
My dad started to practice here in the 1950s into the 1960s and was very fortunate, did a tremendous amount of successful architectural work at LSU. The student union which might be one of his best buildings, is maybe his best known, but all kinds of stuff. Pennington, the Centralplex, renovated the cathedral downtown, the state library, the list goes on and on.
As far as the preservation of these great buildings that were constructed 80 years ago, are we doing a good job?
The buildings were well built. The 19 or so buildings that line the quad are the ones that we focused on initially. They were well built, concrete. There's some frame. There's some problems with the stucco covering. The LSU is behind on maintenance. They do a lot with what little they've got, but there are maintenance issues.
Judy asked about the swimming pool. At the Huey Long Fieldhouse, I see it featured in your book on page 93. One of the just spectacular pieces of architecture at LSU, but it's kind of just sitting there, isn't it?
It's a great question, Judy. It's a significant building. Of course, Huey Long was involved himself. The New Orleans firm, Weiss, Dreyfus, and Seifert were the architects. The university doesn't need it as a swimming pool. That's a big stumbling block. It's an above-ground pool. It's damaged and would be very expensive to repair as a pool and to maintain. They have lots of other hopes for it, though. The new college that resulted from combining education, social work, and kinesiology would like funds to renovate it and put it back into use, but without the pool intact.
Without the pool.
Yeah.
So what would happen?
Well, I haven't seen the plans directly. I've heard about them. I think they'd like to maybe make a lawn or something in the center there and then use the sides on both sides. You know, along the south side, there are all those ball courts, the handball courts, and then on the north side, the old men's changing rooms, and there's a basketball court. There's a lot of room there. Right in the center of campus, and it's a well-built structure, so it's be great to get it back into some use.
Well, but it would be a shame to see the pool go away.
It would be a shame to see the pool go away. Yeah, it would.
I bet you swam in that pool.
Oh, lots of times, sure. Taught my kids how to swim in that pool.
297-5633 for J. Michael Desmond. His book is The Architecture of LSU, appropriately from LSU Press. And we often are provincial, but it's a beautiful campus. When it's measured against other beautiful campuses, how does LSU stack up?
It's unique. It's one of the only Italian Renaissance-based campuses in the United States. The architect, Theodore Link, a German architect working out of St. Louis, wanted to use the Italian Renaissance as a reference because it gave him access to a very rich repertoire of historical examples, and he wanted the campus to be a teaching campus. Mm-hmm. And so the book goes through a number of different layered references to significant historical buildings in our past.
David asks, what significance did Huey Long have on the architecture and the landscape of LSU?
Well, not as much as the myth would say. Long was not governor for a very long time. He had a big impact on the band and the football team. He had some impact on the stadium. Did provide funding for a number of buildings. But then after his untimely death, the federal government and the New Deal came in and really provided a huge new wave of funding that's detailed in the last chapter of the book.
These buildings, like the quadrangle, what's the approximate time when they were constructed?
They were the majority of those were dedicated in 1926. They were built between 22 and 26.
So we're talking 90 years almost.
Yeah.
And the state capitol opened in 1932, so this precedes.
Oh, it does. And look carefully sometime at the tower, Memorial Tower, and its outline and the outline of the state capitol, which was designed later, and you'll see a remarkable similarity.
The architects were different, though, right?
They were.
Ironically, the gentleman who's credited with the state capitol, his name was Weiss.
Yeah.
Not Carl Weiss.
No.
Different Weiss.
Yeah.
He went to jail, didn't he? late in life.
No. I don't think so. Weiss, Dreyfus, and Cephas was a prominent architectural firm in New Orleans.
Right. And I know later in life he had some problems. I'm going to have to find it. But right now, let's go to Pat on I-10. Pat, good morning. You're on the air with J. Michael Desmond. Hi, Pat.
Good morning. Hi, Michael.
Hey, Pat.
I was wondering what sorts of efforts, if any, are in place to maintain the architectural integrity of the campus these days. It's such a beautiful campus. I'm wondering what, is there something in place to ensure that it continues to be so?
Well, they're doing lots of things. There's, of course, lots more that they could do. A lot of people notice the famous surface cracks that are all over the campus. Those appeared early after the buildings were built. It was kind of an innovative stucco technique that was used, and they've been filled across the years with a random collection of caulking, and the university now has a pretty good specification and a really great process developed in part by the architect Jerry Campbell, and all they need is funds to go through and repair all that.
What about future design, though, of new buildings as the campus grows?
Well, that's a great question, Pat. There is an informal set of guidelines that suggest a reference to the Italian Renaissance that hasn't been used as clearly as it might be. The university, in my view, could use a design process, official institutional process of how one selects architects for the campus and how their work is reviewed. I'd hate to see a process that tried to replicate the old, but we do want to do things that are compatible but innovative at the same time. It's one of the things about the student union, my dad's building that Jim was prompting me on earlier. It's a building that couldn't be characterized as Italian Renaissance in any way, but yet most people think that it's compatible and fits in while being inventive. So that'd be a great direction to learn to go in, I think.
Union opened in 64, I believe.
That's
so
right.
Do you like the new configuration?
Not so much.
No? Why? Why not?
I'm all for increased functionality. I think that's great. But they changed some of the design aspects of it in ways that I really don't see as necessary, and the building lost a little bit of its character. But that might just be sentiment talking there. So,
well, the bookstore is now across the street.
Yeah, absolutely
huge
bookstore.
Bookstore is almost as big as the Assembly Center.
It's enormous. Dwarfs the old President's House right in front of it, which is one of Theodore Link's buildings.
Yeah, they did keep a little of the old President's House there, though.
Oh yeah, it's there. It's there. It's in sore need of maintenance. Really covered with cracks, disastrously. Mm-hmm. But a building like the Faculty Club across the street in the other direction is one of those done by Weiss, Dreyfus, and Seifert in the 30s that picked up and mimicked the older style in a delightfully compatible way.
Okay. Question from Hal on government. He asks about the history of the architecture at LSU and whether or not it was influenced by the architecture at Stanford University.
Hal, that's another myth. It comes up all the time. There is a remote similarity in that both campuses are laid out in quadrangles, both use arches, and both have red tile roofs. But from an architectural historian's point of view, the architectural styles are very different. The Stanford's are more of a Romanesque, a stone-based architecture that doesn't make so many direct references to the Italian Renaissance, to the architecture of Andrea Palladio that you see on our campus.
I think I know this, but another question from Ari. What's the oldest building on campus?
Well, the first thing, it depends on how you measure it, but the first thing built on campus was the Swine Palace, the barns there that are shaped now and used as a theater. Those were designed by a firm out of the Midwest, provided by the Olmsted Brothers planning firm, and were the first things that were built. Now, the journalism building was originally was on the old campus downtown and was dismantled and rebuilt. So one could make the point that parts of it are actually older, but
it claims to be the oldest,
and that's the reason.
But it's been redone as well.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah.
I miss the old printing press that was there in the lobby of the journalism school. You mentioned Frederick Law Olmsted. A few months ago, we had a biographer of his on the show, a world-famous architect involved in structures all over the United States, if not the world. What kind of influence did he have on LSU?
Well, this campus, the original plan of the campus was done by his son, Rick, Frederick Law Olmsted, Jr., who ran the firm along with his cousin for decades and decades and decades, and they were enormously prolific and had a huge impact. Rick Olmsted did things that you would recognize. The most prominent would be the mall in Washington, D.C. in its current stage, which he had done before he got involved in LSU. His original approach was based on an approach that his father started, where he would try and understand the natural character, the existing natural character of a natural site, and work in a humble way, work his design and the human purpose into that site so that it would continue in some ways the feeling of the natural form. He laid out the plan. He was the one that helped choose the site. He was the one that used the bluff there in such a dramatic way that decided that the Indian mounds ought to be preserved and become a part of the campus. When the architect, Theodore Link, was hired, Link was asked to simplify the campus. Olmsted's design had been for 3,000 students, and Link was asked to cut it back to 1,500 students. And Link simplified the campus and made it a little more focused on the architecture than Olmsted, the landscape architect, had been.
Question from another listener about the quadrangle, asking if the library is a cohesive attachment to the original quadrangle.
Funny how that library comes up,
yeah.
Isn't it?
Uh-huh.
It was put there in the 1950s. It was done during a time after the war when we were flush with growth and enthusiasm for the new and not as appreciative, perhaps, of the older things as we've learned to be since then. The architects, and I knew the fellow who was the designer of it, the architects understood that it was an awkward place and tried to design it to be compatible in color, to be open on the ground floor, and held it back so that it didn't touch any of the other campus buildings so that you could see the collection of quadrangles around it. Of course, it interrupted this wonderful use of the two axes and the use of compatible buildings and that sort of thing. So there's a lot about it that's unfortunate.
Here's another one about when was the plan for LSU to put dorms in Tiger Stadium implemented?
Oh, that's a good question. That happens in the 1930s, I think.
Yeah. And why?
Well, there was, Huey Long's, the story about that that's apocryphal is that he didn't have funding to build a stadium, but he had funding to do dorms, and if he shaped them like the stadium, he could get them in. I haven't really researched that, so I don't know.
All right. Ronald wants to know your thoughts about the new business school. It's interesting building.
Yeah, interesting building that's modeled after, in a superficial way, the University of Virginia by Thomas Jefferson, with the flanking rows of pavilions and a round building at the end. University of Virginia campus was also a model in some ways for our campus, with the main quadrangle, the main north-south quadrangle, with Stubbs and Prescott and Coates and Dotson lining the quadrangle. So there is that kind of reference, at least.
What do you think about the parking garages on campus now? Does that take away from the beauty?
Not necessarily. I think we need them. They can be done well. There's some beautiful, very effective parking garages around the world. It's a building type that can be done effectively, and the campus really needs them. The cars have had a big impact on ours and other campuses.
What's your favorite building on campus?
My favorite building? Well, Memorial Tower is hard to beat. You know, it's a monument to Louisiana soldiers and sailors that lost their lives in the First World War and to the service and sacrifice necessary in a free society.
The book is The Architecture of LSU from Professor J. Michael Desmond, and hopefully we'll have Dr. Desmond back soon to talk about this passion of his, which is, of course, one of the most beautiful settings in all the world, right here in our community. Thank you, Mike.
You bet.
And we'll return tomorrow, same time, same place. For Kevin Gallagher, I'm Jim Engster. Stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.